So Chuck and Melanie, are you with us?
I am. Good evening, Catherine.
Good evening.
Hi, Catherine. It's Melanie. Good evening.
Hi, Melanie.
Okay. Take it away, Mel. I'm going to start with you. Taxes and the fiscal cliff. Can you give us an overview?
Sure. I'm actually going to be referring to chart one when I start this. So if you guys can take a look at that. When you look at the fiscal cliff, there's actually two elements of the fiscal cliff. There's the tax increases, which is of most concern to most individuals, and then the spending cuts portion of it. And all told, the fiscal cliff's impact would be to decrease the GDP by $650 million, according to the Congressional Budget Office. In absent legislative action, the tax impact in that is going to be around $500,000, which for households is going to average almost $3,500 each, which is approximately 20% above what they would see without the fiscal cliff going into place.
So you mean $500 billion?
Yes, excuse me, $500 billion.
$500 billion. Okay.
Yes. Sorry, $500 billion. Yes. And, you know, absent legislative action, as Catherine mentioned earlier, the most tax cuts that were enacted in the Bush era are going to expire as of January 1st, 2013. And for most households, the two biggest increases are going to be from the expiration of those tax cuts and then also the expiration of a temporary payroll tax cut that's been enacted for the past 2 years.
So just walk us through chart one and show us how big the Bush era tax cuts are relative to the other possible changes.
Sure. So if you look at chart one, you'll see that in terms of the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, that is supposed to have an impact of $180 billion in terms of decreasing the GDP. And that's coming directly out of workers' or individuals' pockets. And in terms of the Bush-era tax cuts, there's really five areas that we're discussing when you think about that. One that most people are aware of course, is the marginal income tax brackets. For the marginal income tax brackets, what you're going to see is that instead of the current rates, which are at 10% on the low end and 35% at the high end, without any action, those are going to increase by 5% so that it's 15% at the low end and as high as 39.6%. The second of most interest is usually the capital gains tax. And the capital gains tax currently, for anyone who is in the 10% tax bracket, they actually pay no long-term capital gains taxes. And anyone above the 10% marginal rate pays a 15% rate on their long-term capital gains. With no changes occurring in 2013, that will increase to 10% for those in the bottom tax bracket and increase to 20% for those anywhere above. At that point, it would be a 15% tax rate. Next would be the qualified dividends. Currently, qualified dividends are taxed at a 15% rate. And if nothing happens in 2013, those would go back to being taxed at ordinary income tax rates. So they would also be taxed at those higher income tax rates that would be put into effect in 2013. And then finally, also, they're not only going to increase your tax rates, they are also going to reduce some of the deductions that are allowed. So if you itemize deductions, currently there were no caps to that itemized deduction. You can deduct as much as you wanted. But with 2013 coming back will be a cap on certain itemized deductions depending on your adjusted gross income. And then also in that same place, there will be a phase-out that will be implemented for the personal exemption rate.
Right.
And then finally, also within the Bush-era tax cuts, the really big onerous portion is the expiration of the estate tax changes. And with the estate taxes, what you see is, again, you're going to increase the top rate. Currently, it's at 35%. It will go up to 55%. And there is currently an estate tax exemption of a little over 5 million, it's 5.12 million. And if nothing happens, that's going to decrease by 1 million. Oh, excuse me, decrease to 1 million. So it's actually essentially a decrease of 4 million that you're going to be losing. And also with that, there's something that's called portability, which means that if you are a surviving spouse and your deceased spouse didn't use all of their estate tax exemption, currently you're able to actually use whatever they didn't use during their estate tax planning or figuring and use that in your total at the end of your life, so that in essence you could exempt up to $10 million at the end of the second spouse's life. And finally, with the estate tax and the gift tax, they're right now actually a unified tax. So at this point in time, the gift tax exemption is also at $5 million. That would reduce back down to $1 million as well.
Right. So you're looking at higher ordinary income rates than higher rates on capital gains and investment income and higher estate. So it's really, it could hit an individual in a whole number of different places, and particularly could really hurt somebody who's dependent on investment income. Because if I'm, let's just look at a little perspective here. If I've been living on investment income, then I've been watching my yields come down tremendously on my fixed income investment, my purchasing power come down because of the debasement. And some of my capital gains are coming from inflation, not really from real gains. They're nominal gains, but I'm getting taxed on the nominal dollar. So this could be a real squeeze on a lot of individuals. Okay.
Yeah, and this only includes the Bush era tax, because we haven't gotten to the rest of this yet. So this is, you can see how onerous this could be. It's going to, I don't know how it's not going to affect virtually everybody in some form or another.
Right. Right. Okay, Mel, anything else on the Bush tax cuts?
Oh, there was one thing that I did want to mention in terms of the capital gains, because I know a lot of your listeners might own actual tangible assets. And in terms of tangible assets, the capital gains rate has actually not changed on that. It's always been 28%, and it will continue to be 28%. So there hasn't been really any change in that regard.
Right, that we know of.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Anything's possible.
Very true.
But as far as we know, the taxes on precious metals have been onerous, and they're going to continue to be onerous.
Yes.
Okay. And again, if you look at the amount of money in terms of budget, I would say that the Bush tax cuts are the biggest pot on the table right now of any of the things we're going to discuss. So let's turn to the payroll tax or the expiration of the payroll tax decrease. Maybe if you could introduce that.
Sure. So the expiration of the payroll tax decrease is actually what happened was in 2010, President Obama declared a what we call a holiday on 2% of Social Security payroll tax for the employee. So the employee used to pay 6.2% into the Social Security fund out of their take-home pay. And in 2010, it got decreased to 4.2%. And so absent any extension on that, the Social Security tax that workers will have to pay will go back to 6.2% as of January 1st, 2013. And the impact is an immediate reduction in your take-home pay.
Yeah, if you wanted to put that in perspective, if the average household takes in $50,000 a year, just that's what we're in and around that area, that means that they're going to have another $1,000 in taxes.
Right. Just from this item.
Just from this specific item. So it's $1,000 in taxes, $1,000 in less take-home pay, and $1,000 towards less living expenses.
Right. Right. Okay, next up is the expiration of the alternative minimum tax patch.
Yes. And so everything that we've talked about so far is actually something that will affect tax year 2013. With the alternative minimum tax patch, this is actually an immediate impact on this current year, 2012's potential tax impact. The alternative minimum tax system was originally created to initially ensure that high-income payers paid some minimum of tax regardless of their deductions and exemptions and credits. And what Congress usually did was institute a patch year over year that would increase the deduction that people could take on figuring out what the alternative minimum tax would be, because originally it was not indexed to inflation. And so a lot of people that weren't necessarily considered the high-income earners were getting caught in this trap because of some of the deductions that they were able to take on their taxes, and then they had to put back into as preference items in figuring out their alternative minimum tax. So if nothing happens, the current deductions that you're able to take are $74,450 for joint filers and $48,450 for any other filer. And that will be reduced to $45,000 for joint filers and $33,750 for any other type of filer. So it's a huge decrease in terms of the deduction that you can take to figure out the alternative minimum tax.
Go for it.
I was just going to say that I don't know if anybody of your listeners or those that understand it can understand the impact, but this is from a magnitude standpoint, this is the largest, I think, that could hit people that aren't aware of it, because the difference, so, you know, the way this, the alternative minimum tax works is it's two taxes. Basically, you have to file two sets of taxes, or you calculate two sets of taxes, your normal rates on how they want you to, and then you have to do another calculation, it's a separate calculation for the alternative minimum tax. And whichever is higher, that's what you got to pay. Okay, so that doesn't sound so bad, but what is bad is that the starting rate on alternative minimum tax, I believe, is 28%, right, Mel?
Yes.
Okay, so if you fall within the alternative minimum tax guidelines and you have, for example, $50,000 of taxable income, if you do it the ordinary way, you might only fall in the 10 or 15% tax bracket. But with the alternative minimum tax, you will now rise to a 28% tax bracket. So you can do the math. That's a minimum of a 13% increase on your taxes on $50,000 or whatever your income is. And it's unbelievably onerous and very surprising if you're not aware of it, because I've gone through that and lived through it. And you think you've planned your taxes really well and you've got everything proportioned appropriately and you're going to, you know, hopefully get a little bit back on your return when you file them, and you find out you owe, in my case, it was tens of thousands of dollars.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that. So people, this is going to, especially because it's going to take effect at the end of this year, people need to be really prepared for this.
So, but it's going to be retroactive.
Yes.
So it will affect your 2012 filing that is due in April.
Exactly.
Yes. So that means it affects your estimateds in January as well.
Yes, it does.
Yes.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me when the three of us went through this the other day, is I almost felt like this was sort of a get California tax, because, you know, I just came back from being out there with all of you in San Francisco area. And I live in Tennessee, which is a state that has no income tax. So I have no deduction. I have no state income tax deduction because I have no state income tax. And I have three properties here in Hickory Valley, and my combined city and county property taxes are $500 a year. Which in San Francisco, you know, I don't think anybody in your area can conceive of property taxes of $500 a year. And so if you're in California and you have, well, think, I mean, I, on just one, this one property, I have an, you know, I have a barn, I have orchards, I have a garden, I have acreage, I have a house, I have big trees, you know, whatever. And I've got, you know, and this property alone is $250 for the year. So when it comes to a state with no income tax and very low cost housing compared to a very high cost area like San Francisco, the AMT could, if you have significant state income tax deductions and mortgage deductions, it could be very painful.
Absolutely. In addition to that, and I know this isn't a part of the fiscal cliff because it's, but it is a tax issue. Next year, because we voted in for the tax increase for state taxes, our tax rates are going from a top level of 10.3% to 13 plus. So we'll be the most taxed state in the union. So this is in addition to the increases in the federal taxes that we're all talking about here.
Right.
Okay, on that cheerful note. Okay, let's go through the additional impacts.
Okay, the additional impacts, and I'm just going to take these in order in terms of their monetary value on the chart. The mandatory spending cuts are those cuts that Catherine referred to in terms of the mandatory cuts that are going to happen if Congress and the President don't agree on an actual spending cut package that is going to pass. And so that's going to be immediate as of January 1st, 2013. The other expiring provisions are a set of tax deductions that are actually more geared towards businesses that are called extenders. And usually what happens is Congress will extend those packages year over year. And most of them, like I said, affect businesses like R&D deductions that are available. And actually for individuals, the biggest thing would actually be for certain credits for education expenses that are currently given to individuals. But if they don't extend them, those are going to go away. The Affordable Care Act, now that is the surtaxes that are going to be hitting people that make $250,000 and there's actually or more. And there's actually two different ones that are going to be put in place in 2013. The first is actually a 0.9% surtax on any income, so this is income, of somebody who makes more than $250,000. And that's going to be paid, it's part of increasing the Medicare portion of your Social Security and Medicare taxes that are charged out of your income. And so instead of just paying 2.9% or actually the employee and the employer split 2.9%, anyone who makes $250,000, any income over $250,000 will have to pay an extra 0.9% on that income. And the second portion of that Affordable Care Act is actually a hit on investment income. So if anyone makes over $250,000 in investment income, and that's interest, dividends, and you know, capital gains, et cetera, anything that's above $250,000 will be charged a surtax of 3.8%, and that's going to go toward what they call the Medicare Contribution Fund, which is going to help pay for things that were passed within the Affordable Care Act.
Okay.
Okay. And then the emergency unemployment benefit, that is the expiration of unemployment extensions of unemployment benefits. It's going to go back to its original 26-week maximum. And then finally, just reduce stimulus spending. That's pretty self-explanatory in terms of they're just going to reduce the amount that they're going to be spending in terms of stimulus.
Okay. Now, we got a question on whether or not the emergency unemployment benefits were going to expire, whether they're going to be renewed or not. And the answer is, I don't know. If you look at where the economy is right now, that's one of the things that is would be most damaging to the economy not to continue those. But I think it's if you look at what the politics are right now, it's surprisingly easy for those to go one way or the other because there's so many controversial issues at hand. I didn't know, Chuck, if you had any other comments on those.
Not really. I just am concerned that this, you know, you're the expert on politics, and you can tell by Melanie speaking, she's the expert on taxes. I just expect this to be the start because we have this, from a political standpoint, there's so much uncertainty, but what we do have is uncertainty is we have a rising deficit and a budget that is completely out of control. And the only way you're going to be able to keep that at least somewhat under control is to print money and to raise taxes. And if anybody thinks that this is going to be the end of tax increases, I think that they need to reconsider that, because this is going to be in our future in some form or another. This is going to continue to squeeze the working person.
We've just gotten a whole series of questions, so let me go back a little bit to the house one. Dear Catherine, rent versus buy, first home in San Francisco. My wife and I are considering the purchase of our first home in the San Francisco Bay Area. We hope to find one along with a mortgage payment, taxes, insurance that will not exceed 25% of our monthly gross income and still leave about 12 to 15% of our budget free for discretionary spending or emergencies. I work as a skilled tradesperson and do not feel very concerned about losing my job or finding work if I do. I'm having a challenging time trying to discern if renting would still be a better option if the economy tanks and unemployment goes up in 2013 like everyone expects. Thanks in advance for your thoughts. Okay, so since we've been talking about that, here's what I would say, and Chuck, you jump in after me. I think it's very important to see which way the tax provisions go and what they do to real estate in the San Francisco Bay Area. My feeling is, the economy in San Francisco is going to be relatively very strong and housing prices will be strong there. So I would be careful to not want to get shut out of the market, but I'd love to see what happens in terms of the tax provisions and things like the alternative minimum tax and what it's going to do to your 2012 and pro forma 2013 taxes. So I would make sure you've penciled this all out before you decide on what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. So Chuck and Melanie, what would you say?
Mel, you want to go?
I think one thing that we're always talking about, especially with buying and the mortgage interest, that's something that's on the table definitely for either ratcheting down in terms of the deductibility and everything else. And so you really have to think about that in terms of whether, when you're actually doing the planning, that it may go away, it may not. So it's definitely an uncertainty that you have to figure when you're thinking about that particular purchase.
And I want to add into that it's especially important when you're on either coast, because of the cost of housing is such a dramatic portion of people's expenses that if you make a minor mistake and it's only 10% of your income and they take away the deductibility of your mortgage expense, then it's not so bad. But if you're stretching it and you're at the limited 25 to 30% where you're allowed to get a loan, you make a minor mistake and they take away that deduction from you, it can mean the difference between, I have to get the heck out of my house now because I can no longer afford it. Doesn't give you a whole lot of latitude to be able to have any errors or any downside or any slowdowns in income.
Subscriber in Tucson would like you to back away from the microphone, Chuck.
Okay.
It's funny. I'm used to being on the phone with you all the time, so I'm used to being close. Another good question I should have asked in the beginning, but this is a good one. Do private practice tax preparers now, quote unquote, work for the IRS? I remember hearing you say that they are now have far more accountability. Where does an honest, hardworking taxpayer go for good advice? Can you comment?
That's if you look at the provisions related to enforcement. To me, from my point of view, the fundamental relationship between somebody preparing taxes or giving tax advice, vis-a-vis the IRS, has changed. But my attitude is obviously you want to find somebody who is trustworthy and who is competent. And my feeling is, what I always say to my tax preparer is, look, I'm not interested in pushing the line. I want to make sure I'm absolutely impeccable in terms of, how I report. And that's what you always want to be. Mel, you're an enrolled agent. So what would you add to that?
I don't actually practice in terms of helping people actually file their taxes. And in general, really, it does come down to finding someone that you can trust. And if you can find someone that you can trust and that you have a good working relationship with, then at least you have somebody that does have that knowledge base and is keeping up with the information that you may not necessarily have the time or the inclination to keep up with.
Okay, so before we go on to actions we can take, I did want to point to everyone to chart number 3. I'm sorry, chart number two up on the both the webinar software, and it's up on the blog if you can't access it through the webinar. What I did with our producer, Kristen Linton, is we got the tax collections from the IRS website since the mid-90s so that you could see the sort of the level of tax collections. And what you'll watch is that the collections rose in most categories as the economy sort of bubbled through 2000. And then in recent years have been coming down. And it's not too hard to look at the numbers and see sort of see what the pinch is. One thing I would note is much of the debate around the fiscal cliff is what will the individual taxes be, and the discussion has been relatively quiet on corporate taxes. And if you look at the historical collections, what I would say is, you know, corporations' share of carrying the load has been flat or dropping, and I think. You know, and we'll talk about this in the wrap up and next year. One question is this the right way to frame it, or do corporate taxes need to be on the table too? And I, of course, would say yes. So now, Mel, let's turn to what can be done to mitigate the impact of the fiscal cliff, if anything, or any of these tax changes. So let's just start to talk through what are people's options, given what we think may happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the main theme really is that at some point or another, tax rates, if nothing happens, are going to rise. And so if that's the case, really, you have to take advantage of lower rates before they potentially increase next year. And there's a couple of ways that you can do that. One potentially is to realize capital gains. That means, you know, if you have built-in gains of some of your positions, it might be a good time to actually think about selling those out, because right now, if you sell them this year, by the end of this year, they'll be taxed at a maximum 15% long-term capital gains rate. And if you do it next year, it's going to go up by 5% to that 20% rate. Now, again,
right. Now, that's if it's in a regular account, not an IRA or retirement account.
Exactly. And again, I got to also remember that it doesn't necessarily, that doesn't apply to the tangible assets unless a PIFIC rule applies, of course.
Okay.
Okay. Another potential thing that clients can do is actually do Roth conversions, because Roth conversions in this case, if it makes sense, where money's not needed immediately due to the 5-year waiting period, it's a way to do that Roth conversion now. Of course, that money that you convert into a Roth is going to be taxable in this year, but at this year's rates, which are going to be lower than potentially next year's rates. And that money that you do convert into a Roth, when it becomes available for qualified distributions, it's going to be currently available to you tax-free. Of course, that could change in the future, but with current laws, it will be tax-free once it becomes a qualified distribution.
I just wanted to note, I put a link in the subscriber space in the blog post to an article you wrote or a blog post you wrote on Roth conversions. But you might just want to go over very simplistically, what is a Roth conversion?
Okay. So a Roth conversion is when you convert a traditional IRA. So that's an IRA that you have been contributing to and have been able to deduct contributions to, and that money is usually, it grows tax deferred like it does in any type of Roth, and so you haven't actually been paying any taxes on any of the gains and or dividends that have been built into that particular account. And what happens is, if you convert it, you take that money and put it into a Roth IRA, and the amount that you convert into a Roth IRA becomes taxable in the year that you do the conversion. So you pay taxes on it now, so that when you go out to take it later, it continues to grow tax deferred, but once you're able to make qualified distributions because of Roth rules, you're able to take money out of Roth IRAs on a tax-free basis. You don't pay any taxes on it at that point in time, because you paid them when you converted the IRA into a Roth.
Right.
At a lower rate.
Okay. So let's keep going.
Okay. Another option is, if you have two types of accounts, one a taxable account and the other some sort of tax-deferred account like an IRA. You may want to shift dividend-paying stocks into the tax-deferred account, because if nothing changes, dividend, the amount of income tax that you have to pay on dividends is going to go up to ordinary income rates from where they currently are now at 15%. So if you don't want to pay that extra tax next year, it may be a good time to, again, realize some capital gains if you have some gains on your dividend-paying stocks, and then potentially buying them back in your tax-deferred account so that when they pay your dividends in the coming years, they're going to be tax-deferred.
Okay.
And then finally, the other thing in terms of estate taxes and estate planning, when appropriate, really, this you could consider accelerating a gifting plan. And the one thing you got to remember with that, of course, is that any gift is irrevocable. And so you have to really make sure that it's appropriate for your situation.
Right. Right. That one I find is one of the trickiest to decide, because you know, if you gift it to make sure you get the exemption under tax law, at the same time there are real issues about diminishing your own flexibility, because it may turn out you need that money. That one can be a tricky one. I'd hate to gift everything and then wake up tomorrow and discover they hadn't dropped the exemption after all.
Yep, very true.
One more question in from Los Angeles, a real estate question. Is the mortgage interest deduction related to owner property or investment property?
It usually applies to owner property. It can be, in some cases, in terms of deduction, the mortgage interest can be deducted on investment property as well, but it's usually falling into an actual deduction based on the property itself.
Right. So it's a project deduction, not a general
Yes.
deduction. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The other thing I would like to mention is that when you look at the feasibility or sort of the attractiveness of working longer hours to make more money versus doing more for yourself, I have to admit that the more taxes rise, the more attractive it is to, you know, not generate the revenues, but instead use the time to do things that significantly lower your expenses. So depending on your situation, it can really make it a lot more attractive to do things for yourself. Okay, Chuck, you had some things to add, and I know we have chart three that you wanted to describe, which is fascinating.
Well, the one thing I did want to make sure that one of the other topics that I think we skipped over with regards to what somebody can do to help mitigate these changes. Mel, did you mention the fact that you should be pulling in revenue into this year, if at all possible?
Oh.
So if you have the ability to recognize revenue in 2012
right.
rather than 2013, mm-hmm. I think that's another thing that you can do. It's kind of like, you know, taking your tax hit this year, pulling the revenue this year so it, you know, gets taxed at a lower rate.
Yes.
Right. And in fact, we had a question. Let me just read it. I'm a freelance consultant. I'm on the verge of receiving a large check for a project that I've done for a U.S. company. I could either get the payment now before the new year or after the new year. Since you forecast taxes are going to rise next year, would you recommend that I hold the payment till next year or the other way around?
Well, me, I would, you know, nobody can tell the exact situation and how this thing is going to actually play out with Congress and the president, but I would take the revenue now. That's what I'm doing personally.
Right, and some of it depends on what their other, you know.
Yes.
The other situation. Yes.
Yeah, their other situation.
Right.
See, I have the advantage that none of you all have. I have a lifetime of tax loss carry forwards. So it's a different situation. Chart three, Chuck.
Can I just add one other thing before we jump into chart three? Because, you know, again, this is about, for me, this is about what can be done, and part of what can be done for me is managing expectations. And, you know, I don't remember, I think you mentioned one of your listeners, I think it was about the question in housing in San Francisco, you know, they were expecting projected growth in 2013. Well, actually, what I have, you know, I went to a couple of the government websites, and their projection for growth in 2013 is 0.9%. So what I want to do is just set an expectation for for what people should potentially expect if this thing goes through. So what we've done is we've quantified this, and we said this potential impact, the $650 million of all of these tax increases and exemption deductions, et cetera, has an effect of approximately 4.7% of GDP. So if you take a look, and if we only grow 0.9%, and you have the potential of taking out 4.7%, you do the math, and that works out to be, you know, a 3.8% contraction. So what does that mean? I'm just trying to put this in context. Please don't take it like I'm predicting this, but if you use 2008, 2009 as a reference point, we had a 3.1% contraction during that period of time, and we all saw what happened to, you know, investment assets, whether they be stocks or bonds or gold, precious metals, our homes, all of those things. Now, I don't think that's going to happen. It's a completely different scenario, but we don't know what's going to play out here. And so, again, my point is to manage expectations, and that is a potential, you know, outcome as far as I'm concerned.
Right. Now, we have a series of questions on IRAs and 401ks that I want to turn to. And I've watched some of the – I know the president's proposal had had one proposal to encourage 401ks for small businesses, and we've seen that proposal floating around in various conditions. If you look at the negotiations that are going on, they're going on right now at things that generate much more immediate revenues for the budget. So I don't think IRAs or 401ks have been at the top of anybody's list in Washington. So they're kind of down on the list. But we have a series of questions of, one, would you start to take money out of IRAs now, or would you, would you put money into IRAs given what's going on? And I'll just kick this off because I think everybody has a different opinion. But what I find is it's very unique to the individual situation. And what I try and encourage people to do is simply not have all their eggs in any basket, including the IRA basket. And certainly if you have a lot in IRA, you ought to take a look at the Roth conversion. And again, Mel did a great little piece, and it's up. You can link to it from the links in the subscriber area. I would suggest you take a look at it. But I would invite both of you to kick in because, as you know, I have a terrible prejudice on this, having said never again being slammed by the government on my 401k, but I find it's very unique to the individual. So I have a hard time always answering this question generically, but let me kick it over to each of you.
Go for it, Mel.
Well, unfortunately, I was actually going to say the same thing, which is it is going to be unique to the person's situation. And if it's, you know, that's the one thing you got to remember is that it is potential that you're going to taxes are going to increase. A way to try to mitigate that could be to, you know, you could either do one of two things, which is take some money out and realize that income now, or contribute more. But it is really going to be up to the individual situation.
It's very interesting. At the subscribers luncheon in Murfreesboro, we got a request to do a show on self-directed IRAs, and the theory was if I use my IRA to do private venture, you know, or small business investment, it will be sufficiently illiquid that the government can't take it or mess with it or, you know, force me to sell it and put it in an annuity. So as a lover of liquidity, it was very upsetting to hear, but the idea of putting it in something illiquid is becoming increasingly attractive. Anyway, so I thought that was an interesting, but we also got a question from somebody saying, would you suggest I put my IRA into a self-directed IRA, into something quite illiquid, because then I can not wake up and find that the Treasury has determined that it has to go into an annuity.
I have a feeling, though, Catherine, if that comes about and they really do need the money, they're going to find whatever the way that they need to make those illiquid things pretty liquid.
Right.
If they need the money, that
way.
Yep.
I agree.
But one thing I just wanted to add, and I'm not going to parrot what you guys said because you're, I think, both spot on. My only comment would be is that when people are planning for retirement, and this is an adjunct issue, the best thing you can do is to take a look at your position, and you want to go into retirement with a good balance of money between your IRA and non-IRA funds. So to answer that question, would I contribute going forward? You know, yes, all of those concerns about taxes and confiscation or whatever you want to call it. But I would also take into account that if I'm imbalanced and I have most of my assets in non-IRA funds, then I would, me personally, I can't tell everybody else what to do, but I would want to continue to contribute to my IRA. If the converse is true, I would probably forego giving up the tax deductibility and just take it, you know, pay the taxes on it and go find another home for it.
Right. Right. And that's why I think it's very unique to the individual situations. Okay. Well, Chuck, you want to just describe chart three? Because I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, an interesting chart in the sense that, so if you look at the top line, the black line there, that's the total tax receipts as a percentage of private GDP. So that you could see that trend is, you could draw a trend line, and it's actually moving upwards. But the green line, which is a total, it's a annual revenue growth of GDP, is actually going down. So our GDP is going down, but the tax receipts from the private sector are going up. So what that's telling you is that, I mean, for me, what that's saying to me is that they're squeezing, you know, more and more money is being taken away from the private sector in the form of, you know, in form of taxes.
Right, and that's what we've seen is the economy. You know, what's happened is the government, in my opinion, the government's behaved in a series of ways over the last 20 years that shrinks the pie, and now it's coming back to bite them because the pie is shrinking, and you know, and it's hurting their tax receipts, and now they want a bigger piece of the pie. And the reality is what we need to do is get out of that spiral, and whatever we do, we need to re-engineer in a way that makes the pie bigger. So it's not just a matter of balancing the budget. It's balancing the budget of the whole economy, not just the government. So the Sheriff of Nottingham cannot solve this problem alone. We need Robin Hood.
And Little John.
And Little John, you're right. Okay, so before we close, any other points that you would like to make?
None for me.
None for me either.
Okay, well, today is December 6th, and I think, you know, one of the things I think is if you're going to do something, it's good to do the transaction before the very end of the month. So this, hopefully this will give subscribers about 2 weeks to look at their own unique situation and talk to the appropriate person in your life. And if there are any transactions to be done, hopefully do it before the end of the year. So with that, Chuck and Melanie, thank you very much. You're going to, as I said, Chuck's going to be back with us for the equity overview on January 18th, and we're looking forward to that. And so Mel and Chuck, have a great evening. And again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Catherine.
Talk to you later.